Coming up on today's program, microplastics and major discoveries. I'm Jerry Kenney. This is WISA Weekend. As always, thanks for sharing your weekends with WISO. We've got Veterans Voices coming up later in the program. Also, WYSO Youth Radio and a look at that major discovery. Up first, microplastic pollution is a growing concern. It can affect the environment, animals, and people. The University of Cincinnati received a $3.3 million grant to study the effects of microplastic on the human heart. Hong Shang Wang is a professor in the Department of Pharmacology, Physiology, and Neurobiology, and the lead researcher of this study. He tells WISO's Mike Frazier how microplastics accumulate in the cardiovascular system. He starts our conversation by saying that microplastics have been detected in the arterial plaque of some patients.
And the higher the level of microplastics in the plaques, the higher the likelihood of downstream cardiovascular events, such as heart attack and mortality.
Okay, so does that mean that if somebody has a buildup of cholesterol in their cardiovascular system, it could be aggravated by microplastics?
There are a number of ways that microplastic, when they are present in the plaque, can, for instance, destabilize the plaque. But we are at the very early stage of microplastic research, and this is partly where our project comes in.
So how do microplastics and nanoplastics get into the body?
So the major source is through ingestion, through food, through water, through beverage. A second route of exposure is inhalation. So because they are really tiny particles and the suspension, we're talking about microplastic, they can be suspended in the air and we just breathe them in. So it's inhalation exposure.
So tiny plastics are actually in the air and we breathe it in and it gets into our bodies that way? I didn't know that.
Yeah, it's crazy, isn't it? So they're basically like dust because they are really, really small. They're not like bits and pieces that you can see. They can suspend in the air and that's where inhalation exposure comes in. But the major route is ingestion through food, through beverage, and water.
When someone consumes microplastics, does the body not filter it out, say, through the digestive system or the urinary tract? Is it so small that it just actually gets into our bloodstream?
Oh, that's an excellent question. The larger particles basically travels right through us. You basically find plastics in just about everybody you look at. So then people realize, wow, you know, there's such common exposure. So that's the bigger pieces that will just go right through us. But the smaller pieces can enter the body, enter the blood circulation, and gets distributed in various tissues, let's say including the heart, and another site where will demonstrate this microplastic exposure is the brain. And even inside cells where they can cause potential damage.
So the microplastics can actually be inside cells?
Yeah. Pretty crazy stuff, isn't it?
Wow. This is more intense than I thought it would be.
Certain steps that individuals can take to reduce, not to eliminate, but reduce exposure to microplastics, simply based on what we know about human exposure to plastics. For instance, I try to reduce the number of plasticware in my kitchen. I do not use a plastic cutting board, but I use a wood or bamboo cutting board. I definitely do not heat food in a plastic container in a microwave. If you heat up the plastics, it releases even more microplastics. And I drink tap water instead of bottled water because the study showed that the level of microplastic in a bottled water can be quite a bit higher than the straight tap water. you can get a good quality water filtration system, that's even better. So that's the kind of the common sense steps that us individuals can take. Because we're really talking about exposure to environmental pollutants that's present on a very large scale. And because plastic is made, produced in vast quantities, and it's widely present in the environment, right? So there's only so much an individual can do to truly address this question. We will take the action of the community, of the society.
That was Hongsheng Wang, professor in the Department of Pharmacology, Physiology, and Neurobiology, and the lead researcher of this study. He spoke with WISO's Mike Frazier. The study is funded for 5 years, but Wang says their research into the effects of microplastics on people will continue after the five-year funding period ends. Mike will be back later in the program with a look at why appliances are a little harder to fix these days. Up next on WISO Weekend, Cindy LaPointe Daffler of Jefferson Township is a Gold Star wife, the surviving spouse of a member of the U.S. Armed Forces who died while serving on active duty or as a result of service-related causes. In today's episode of Veterans Voices, she reflects on the life and sacrifice of her late husband, Joseph Guy LaPointe Jr., an Army combat medic who was posthumously awarded the Medal of Honor. This story is an encore presentation that first aired on May 20th in 2020.
The first time I saw him was in the summer of 1967. I saw him across the room in a church basement coffee shop. He was on stage singing and playing. He had the most open, smiling face. His eyes smiled. His face just lit up when he smiled. That was my first impression, is just he was beautiful. In December, I mean, we had been dating for a while, and in December, I finally confessed to him that I loved him. And his reaction was to leap out of my house, climb up the tree, and shout to the world, "She loves me." And it just, even today, it gives me chills. And, well, of course, there was a draft going on. He had applied to several colleges, and then he received his draft notice. His take on it was that he would not refuse service, period. He was going to serve. His father served in World War II. He would not dishonor his father. The weekend before he left for basic training, we went to Roosevelt Shawnee State Park and spent the day there, very much alone. A little later on, I realized the results of that day, and we ended up getting married on August 24th of 68. I remember when we got the first telegram was to tell us he was missing in action. And a few days later, two soldiers came to the door. Very classic, I guess. And they brought the second telegram, told us he had been killed in action. Our son was 5 months old at the time. That was when you hear people say the word gut-wrenching. That's what it is. It felt like my guts had been ripped out, and I just went in my room. I remember when he got on the plane to go to Vietnam and his face in the window. That was hard. We went to Vietnam in 1999, after Guy was killed. So a group of us went to the hill, 376, and we trudged up that hill in 100-degree heat. I felt such a pull to get up there. My son was with me, and my sister Candy was with me. we felt like they were, their spirits were there, the ones who died that day. Our son Joe felt it too. Candy felt it. I think we all did.
Veterans Voices is presented by Wright-Patt Credit Union. Additional support comes from the Dayton Ombudsman Veterans Transition Team and Montgomery County Veterans Service Commission. Veterans Voices is produced at the Eichelberger Center for Community Voices, as is WISO Youth Radio. That's coming up in just a few moments. Up next, we've got the story of that major discovery on Today from the Ohio Newsroom.
Support comes from the James at Ohio State. Cancer. For some, it's one of life's fiercest foes. But not at the James, where a team of nearly 300 specialists and over 1,500 researchers are working together to create a cancer-free world.
Today from the Ohio Newsroom takes you around the state, connecting you with news and neighbors from all over Ohio. I'm Claire Roth. Recently, archaeologists began digging in a field in Granville after a perfect circle appeared in their subsurface imaging. They believe they may have discovered the remnants of a previously unknown Hopewell earthwork built millennia ago. Ali Grinsick from Ohio Newsroom member station WOSU headed to Granville to see what they found.
Denison University anthropology professor John Soderberg has dug himself into a hole. Well, it's a trench. And Soderberg hopes it will provide evidence of a long-lost earthen circle built by indigenous people thousands of years ago. The field off Newark Granville Road belongs to the village and is home to several known archaeological sites that show evidence of being inhabited for around 10,000 years. But if there was an earthwork here, farmers virtually erased it with 200 years of plowing.
What we're doing here is kind of called ground truthing, is, okay, we've got this weird anomaly that shows up. Can we figure out what it is?
Soderberg walks along the 50-foot-long trench. For the most part, a clear line divides the lower layer of yellow-orange clay and the upper brown-colored soil. Soderberg looks for changes that indicate humans once moved the dirt. He finds one.
Suddenly, this really clear, easy division between that yellow layer and the brown layer goes away.
It happens again a little further down the trench. This could be the circle they saw on the imaging.
This is not dramatic, like, oh my God, here we got it, archaeology. This is really subtle, small changes.
It's slow work on a hot day. The sun beats down as Soderberg and Brad Lepper, an expert on earthworks with Ohio History Connection's World Heritage Program, step into a second perpendicular trench to search for matching disturbances in the soil where the circle would curve around. Nothing immediately jumps out to Lepper.
Archaeology isn't just about digging holes and finding cool stuff. It's about answering questions and solving problems. And sometimes those problems aren't solvable in a limited excavation.
If this is an earthwork, it may have served a different purpose than the much larger, more complex earthworks in nearby Newark that are believed to have been part of a sprawling ceremonial hub.
So these tiny circles might be community churches or shrines or things like that.
The team decides to keep digging. Later, Soderberg creates a 3D model of the site. And then he sends an email to the dig team, as recent Denison graduate Emma Hall explains.
It was like anomalies if they're circles or something. And he sent it at like 10 o'clock at night after he had like worked on them all day. Yeah, Dr. Soderberg. The way that he mapped it, it's super convincing.
It seems they had discovered an earthen circle. Hall and other student archaeologists took their findings to Granville's Planning Commission.
Okay. So you guys might be familiar with the Pyramid of Giza, right? The Great Wall of China, the Colosseum. Imagine Granville, Ohio for me. Granville, Ohio is a place of great historical significance, archaeological significance, and that's what we're going to be talking about today.
Still, their evidence isn't definitive. There's more work to be done, says recent Denison graduate Eli Lishak.
The shining golden treasure doesn't appear the first hole that we make, right? And even the second hole, the third hole.
Soderberg says the team will analyze the results and do some carbon dating in the coming weeks and months. That's okay. The answer to this mystery has been buried for thousands of years. It can wait a little longer. In Granville, I'm Allie Begrinsick.
That's all today from the Ohio Newsroom. We'll talk with you tomorrow.
You can hear daily episodes of Today from the Ohio Newsroom weekdays at 6:44 a.m. and p.m. on 91.3 WYSO. You can also find them on our website at WYSO.org. WYSO Youth Radio brings you stories from local high school students. Here's this week's entry.
Hey there, I'm Lee Wade, and you just tuned into WYSO Youth Radio. When teachers and students at Chaminade Julienne High School started digging into the history of a small corner of campus, they uncovered a connection to a remarkable Dayton story from the past.
Hi, my name is Elise Dancy, and I'm a senior at Chaminade Julienne Catholic High School. We recently discovered that some significant Dayton history happened in the northern part of our CJ campus. To find out more about this discovery, I interviewed Uriah Moorhead, a junior, and Eric Daniel, a senior. Eric?
Well, we discovered that the church where Paul Lawrence Dunbar and his mother attended was on our campus.
Who was Paul Lawrence Dunbar?
Paul Lawrence Dunbar is one of the most influential African-American poets of the late 19th century. He was a pioneering African-American writer who authored over 400 poems, 12 poetry collections, 4 novels, 4 short story collections, and a Broadway musical, and while addressing racial prejudice, the joys of life, and the African-American experience in the post-emancipation era.
Yes, Paul Lawrence Dunbar is one of the many historic figures that the Dayton community takes pride in as a hometown scholar. He was born on June 27, 1872, in Dayton, Ohio. His parents had been enslaved in Kentucky before his birth, with his father escaping to get his freedom and later serving in the Union Army in Massachusetts. Although Dunbar grew up poor, his parents encouraged him to get a good education, and he started writing poetry as a child.
Tell us more about his church.
The Wayman AME Church congregation was founded in 1833 and is recognized as Dayton's first black congregation. The same year that Dunbar was born, the AME Church decided to relocate their congregation to 86 Eaker Street, which is known as the Eaker Street AME Church.
According to Dayton Aviation Heritage National Historical Park, the organization that oversees the museum at his house, Dunbar wrote his first poem, An Easter Ode, in 1878, and recited it at his first public reading at the Eaker Street AME Church in 1884, when he was just 12 years old.
I took Mr. Mix's African-American Studies class in the fall. I don't really remember us discussing this.
Mr. Mix was looking up information on the Wayman AME Church. He came across the historical marker, noting that a church stood on Eaker Street, where Paul Lawrence Dunbar attended. He went to the CJ historian, who found the 1918 Sanborn fire insurance map that showed where the church was located on the block. Comparing that map to a current property line map from Dayton confirmed that it was located where CJ's Founder Center is currently.
Founders houses CJ Middle School and CJ Business Communications and Alumni and Development Offices. It covers several property lots. 86 Eaker, where the church was, is the room where our Eagle Learning Center and our Study Hall and Tutor Center is currently located. This narrow but long room is also the entryway to our new CJ Middle School, where Mrs. Lawford, the principal, has her desk.
After discovering this in January, knowing Paul Lawrence Dunbar's funeral was in February, did you guys do anything to commemorate it?
Mr. Mix's African American Studies courses visited the site of his funeral in remembrance of a day in legend and to acknowledge all of Paul Lawrence Dunbar's contributions during the 100th anniversary of Black History Month.
Wow, thank you guys so much for all the information. It is crazy to think that at one point our campus had the church attended by this pioneering African-American writer from Dayton. There's a lot of history on Eaker, this short street between the north ends of our football stadium and tennis courts.
So while CJ students are busy writing essays, it's pretty cool to know that one of Dayton's greatest writers may have once stood in the very same spot, sharing his own words with the world. Special thanks to Brian Mix and Susan Marticello for helping bring this project to life. WYSO Youth Radio is made possible with support from the Ohio Arts Council and is produced right here at WYSO and the Eichelberger Center for Community Voices.
Catch a new episode of WYSO Youth Radio every Thursday and a Sunday during this program and podcast, and listen to past episodes anytime at WYSO.org. Up next, Mike Frazier returns with a conversation about repairing things. Maybe you're someone who likes to repair appliances, cars, and personal electronics, but find it harder to do so today. Well, you can blame VCRs and videotapes. That's the link found by Juana Godeno-Kenworthy, a professor of American Studies in the Department of Global and Intercultural Studies at Miami University. Mike spoke to her about her research on why it's harder to fix consumer products.
Video recorders allowed consumers to record entertainment from TV and to copy tapes of movies with very little to no control from those who had created that content. So this ability of the technology, which in some ways empowered consumers to do whatever they wanted with their content, represented a financial threat to Hollywood, which then started thinking of ways to protect its interests, and that led to discussions around what copyright meant in the late 70s and 1980s when this new technology emerged.
And how does that link to today's problem, at least with some people, of the difficulty of repairing consumer products?
First, they tried to outlaw the technology. So in 1976, a group of Hollywood studios took Sony to court on the grounds that the video recorders encouraged consumers to break copyright laws. The case made its way through court, and when the Supreme Court decided that actually videotaping content from TV did not infringe copyright law and rather fell under the purview of the fair use exemption to copyright laws, then as content became digital and moved online, the industry turned to other forms of control. So that's what we have step two, the digital rights management stage in the story. But those technological tools that the industry developed in order to control user access to content, right? It can be encryption software, different types of authentication or enforcement software, which limit what kind of digital activities we can perform with our content. The third step in the story was legal protection, the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, DMCA, which was signed into law by President Bill Clinton in 1998. So this legal document also reflected a new alignment in interest between the entertainment industry and the kind of budding software industries in the U.S. And it really marks the moment when these legal obstacles to repairs are born, because the DMCA increased existing penalties for copyright infringement online and criminalized any technology used to bypass technological locks.
Did you want to talk about how this is contributing to the rise of the right to repair movement?
Yeah, so this inability to repair items leads to all sorts of absurd situations where to have something repaired is almost as expensive as just buying something new. It will cost slightly more to buy new, but for a consumer who is given the choice between paying slightly less for a repair and purchasing a new item, which is marketed aggressively, is presented as being superior to older models, and in many cases comes with a warranty, they will tend to just throw in the trash the old item and go for the new one. If repairing was cheap, people would keep things longer and fix them instead of always going to buy new things. This has an impact on the pocketbooks of ordinary consumers. It also has a significant environmental impact, right? Americans are the second largest producers of e-waste in the world after China. I think it's 43 pounds per person per year. And the materials that go in our electronic waste, you know, from rare minerals to metal to copper, all of that is wasted every time we throw away an item in the trash, because less than a quarter gets recycled.
Is that something you would tell people who are, like you said, frustrated with the inability to fix something that would be cheaper and restore its functionality than having to go out and buy a new item?
Yes. So, well, there are two things. You can call your representative, but you can also try to learn to repair things. Or shopping from companies that provide or demonstrate that their products have information about how to repair simple things yourself would also be an option if those types of companies and products exist. But also being aware of this type of legislation, which may not be very glamorous, but does have an impact on everybody's pocketbook and on the environment.
That was Juana Godeno-Kenworthy, teaching professor of American Studies in the Department of Global and Intercultural Studies at Miami University, speaking with WISO's Mike Frazier. And by the way, Ohio currently has a right to repair bill pending. SB 176 would require manufacturers to provide tools, parts, and documents to repair digital equipment.
This is Bird Note. Sunrise on a summer morning. In marshes throughout the country, birds awaken. Tall, dense grasses and reeds often make marsh birds hard to see, but their voices carry easily across the lush, green landscape. A male redhead. The sora. An American bittern. The marsh wren. A yellow-headed blackbird song. A pied-billed grebe. A ruddy duck. And a Wilson snipe. For Bird Note, I'm Mary McCann. Bird Note gives you the sounds of birds every day, and you get the sights as well when you follow us on Instagram at Bird Note Radio.
Bird Note, putting a lofty wrap to our program today. I'm Jerry Kenny. Thanks for joining us for this program and podcast. You can download and subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Our theme music is Another Beautiful Day in Paradise by Magnolia Bolthead. Join us next weekend. We've got more conversations and highlights for you then.